Chapter 7. Parking his motor scooter in the faculty lot just below the observatory dome, Binet went jogging quickly up the footpath that led to the main entrance of the huge building. As he began to ascend the wide stone steps of the entranceway itself, he was startled to hear someone calling his name from above.
"Binet, so you are here after all."
The astronomer looked up. The tall, heavy-set, powerful figure of his friend, Theremin 762 of the Saro City Chronicle, stood framed in the great door of the observatory.
"Theremin, were you looking for me?"
"I was, but they told me you weren't due to show up here for another couple of hours. And then, just as I was leaving, there you were anyway. Talk about serendipity." Binet trotted up the last few steps, and they gave each other a quick hug. He had known the newspaper man some 3 or 4 years, ever since the time Theremin had come to the observatory to interview some scientist, any scientist, about the latest manifesto of the Crackpot Apostles of Flame group. Gradually, he and Theremin had become close friends, even though Theremin was some 5 years older and came out of a rougher, worldlier background. Binet liked the idea of having a friend who had no involvement whatsoever in university politics, and Theremin was delighted to know someone who wasn't at all interested in exploiting him for his considerable journalistic influence.
"Is something wrong?" Binet asked.
"Not in the least, but I need to get you to do the Voice of Science routine again. Mondior's made another of his famous repent, repent, doom is coming speeches. Now he says he's ready to reveal the exact hour when the world will be destroyed. In case you're interested, it's going to happen next year on the 19th of Theptar, as a matter of fact."
"That madman. It's a waste of space printing anything about him. Why does anyone pay the slightest bit of attention to the apostles anyway?"
Theremin shrugged. "The fact is that people do. A lot of people, Binet. And if Mondior says the end is nigh, I need to get someone like you to stand up and say, 'Not so, brothers and sisters. Have no fear, all is well.' Or words to that effect. I can't count on you, can I, Binet?"
"You know you can."
"This evening?"
"This evening. Oh, Lord, Theremin, this evening's a real mess. How much of my time do you think you'd have to have?"
"Half an hour? 45 minutes?
"Look," Binet said, "I've got an urgent appointment right now. That's why I'm here ahead of schedule. After that, I've sworn to Raista that I'll hustle back home and devote, well, an hour or two to her. We've been on such different tracks lately that we've hardly seen each other at all. And then later in the evening, I'm supposed to be here at the observatory again to supervise taking a bunch of photographs of..."
"All right," said Theremin. "I see I've picked the wrong time for this. Well, listen, no problem, Binet. I've got until tomorrow afternoon to turn in my story. What if we talk in the morning?"
"The morning?" Binet said doubtfully.
"I know morning's an unthinkable concept for you. But what I mean is I can get back up here at Ono's Rise just as you're finishing up your evening's work. If you could simply manage a little interview with me before you go home to go to sleep..."
"Well, for a friend, Binet."
Binet gave the journalist a weary look.
"Of course I will. That's not the issue. It's just that I may be so groggy after a whole evening of work that I may not be of any use to you."
Theremin grinned. "That doesn't worry me. I've noticed that you're capable of de-groggifying pretty damned quickly when there's anti-scientific nonsense for you to refute. Tomorrow at Ono's Rise, then? In your office upstairs?"
"Right."
"A million thanks, pal. I'll owe you one for this."
"Don't mention it."
Theremin saluted and began to head down the steps. "Give my best to that beautiful lady of yours," he called, "and I'll see you in the morning."
"See you in the morning, yes," Binet echoed. How odd that sounded. He never saw anybody, or anything, in the morning. But he'd make an exception for Theremin. That was what friendship was all about, wasn't it?
Binet turned and entered the observatory. Inside, all was dimly lit and calm, the familiar hush of the Great Hall of Science where he had spent most of his time since his early university days. But the calm was, he knew, a deceptive one. This mighty building, like the more mundane places of the world, was constantly a swirl with conflicts of all sorts, ranging from the loftiest of philosophical disputes down to the pettiest of trivial feuds, spats, and backbiting intrigues. Astronomers, as a group, were no more virtuous than anyone else. All the same, the observatory was a sanctuary for Binet and for most of the others who worked there, a place where they could leave most of the world's problems behind and devote themselves, more or less peacefully, to the everlasting struggle to answer the great questions that the universe posed. He walked swiftly down the long main hall,
trying as always, without success, to muffle the clatter of his boots against the marble floor. As he invariably did, he glanced quickly into the display cases along the wall to the right and left, where some of the sacred artifacts of the history of astronomy were on perpetual exhibit. Here were the crude, almost comical telescopes that such pioneers as Chector and Stanta had used 400 or 500 years before. Here were the gnarled black lumps of meteorites that had fallen from the sky over the centuries, enigmatic reminders of the mysteries that lay behind the clouds. Here were first editions of the great astronomical sky charts and textbooks, and the time-yellowed manuscripts of some of the epoch-making theoretical works of the great thinkers. Binet paused for a moment before the last of those manuscripts, which, unlike the others, seemed fresh and almost new, for it was only a single generation old, Athor 77's classic codification of the theory of universal gravitation, worked out not very long before Binet himself had been born. Though he was not a particularly religious man, Binet stared at that thin sheaf of paper with something very much like reverence, and found himself thinking something very much like a prayer. The theory of universal gravitation was one of the pillars of the cosmos for him, perhaps the most basic pillar. He couldn't imagine what he would do if that pillar were to fall, and it seemed to him now that the pillar might be tottering. At the end of the hall, behind a handsome bronze door, was Dr. Athor's own office. Binet glanced at it quickly and hurried past it, up the stairs. The venerable and still formidable observatory director was the last person in the world, absolutely the last, that Binet wanted to see at this moment. Pharaoh and Yimo were waiting for him upstairs in the chart room, where they had arranged to meet. "Sorry I'm a little late," Binet said. "It's been a complicated afternoon so far." They gave him nervous, owlish smiles. What a strange pair they are, he thought, not for the first time. They both came from some backwater farming province, Sithin maybe, or Gatamber. Pharaoh 24 was short and roly-poly, with a languid, almost indolent way of moving. His general style was easygoing and casual. His friend, Yimo 70, was incredibly tall and thin, something like a hinged ladder with arms, legs, and a face, and you practically needed a telescope to see his head looming up there in the stratosphere above you. Yimo was as tense and twitchy as his friend was relaxed. Yet they were inseparable, always had been. Of all the young graduate students, one notch down the observatory's table of organization from Binet's level, they were by far the most brilliant. "We haven't been waiting long," Yimo said at once. "Only a minute or two, Dr. Binet," Pharaoh added. "Not quite, Doctor, yet, thanks," Binet said. "I've still got the final inquisition to go through. How did you manage with those computations?" Yimo said, twitching and jerking his impossibly long legs around, "This is gravitational stuff, isn't it, sir?" Pharaoh nudged him so vigorously in the ribs with his elbow that Binet expected to hear the sound of crunching bone. "That's all right," Binet said. "Yimo's correct, as a matter of fact." He gave the tall young man a pale smile. "I wanted this to be a purely abstract mathematical exercise for you, but it doesn't surprise me that you were able to figure out the context. You figured it out after you had your result, didn't you?"
"Yes, sir," said Yimo and Pharaoh at the same time. "We ran all the calculations first," Pharaoh said.
"Then we took a second look, and the context became apparent," said Yimo. "Ah, yes," Binet said. These kids were sometimes a little unnerving. They were so young. Only 6 or 7 years younger than he, as a matter of fact, but he was an assistant professor, and they were students, and to him and them both, that was a vast barrier. Young as they were, though, they had such extraordinary minds. He wasn't altogether pleased that they had guessed at the conceptual matrix within which these calculations were located. In fact, he wasn't pleased at all. In another few years, they'd be right up here on the faculty with him, perhaps competing for the same professorship he hoped to get, and that might not be fun. But he tried not to think about that. He reached for their printout. "May I see?" he asked. Hands fluttering wildly, Yimo handed it over. Binet scanned the rows of figures, calmly at first, then with rising agitation. He had been pondering all year long certain implications of the theory of universal gravitation, which his mentor, Athor, had brought to such a summit of perfection. It had been Athor's great triumph, the making of his lofty reputation, to work out the orbital motions of Calgash and all six of its suns according to rational principles of attractive forces. Binet, using modern computational equipment, had been calculating some aspects of Calgash's orbit around Onos, its primary sun,
when to his horror, that his figures didn't check out properly in terms of the theory of universal gravitation. The theory said that at the beginning of the present year, Calgash should have been here in relation to Onos, when in undeniable fact Calgash was there. The deviation was trivial, a matter of a few decimal places, but that wasn't trivial at all in the larger sense of things. The theory of universal gravitation was so precise that most people preferred to refer to it as the law of universal gravitation. Its mathematical underpinning was considered impeccable. But a theory that purports to explain the movements of the world through space has no room for even small discrepancies. Either it is complete or it is not complete. No middle way was permissible. And a difference of a few decimal places in a short-range calculation would widen into a vast abyss, Binet knew, if more ambitious computations were attempted. What good was the whole theory of universal gravitation if the position that it said Calgash was going to hold in the sky a century from now turned out to be halfway around Onos from the planet's actual location then? Binet had gone over his figures until he was sick of reworking them. The result was always the same. But what was he supposed to believe? His numbers or Athor's towering master scheme? His piddling notions of astronomy or the great Athor's profound insight into the fundamental structure of the universe? He imagined himself standing right on top of the dome of the observatory calling out, "Listen to me, everybody. Athor's theory is wrong. I've got the figures right here that disprove it." Which would bring forth such gales of laughter that he'd be blown clear across the continent. Who was he to set himself up against the titanic Athor? Who could possibly believe that a callow assistant professor had toppled the law of universal gravitation? And yet, his eyes raced over the printout sheets that Yimo and Pharaoh had prepared. The calculations on the first two pages were unfamiliar to him. He had set up the data for the two students in such a way that the underlying relationships from which the numbers were derived were not at all obvious, and evidently they had approached the problem in a way that any astronomer trying to compute a planetary orbit would regard as quite unorthodox, which was exactly what Binet had wanted. The orthodox ways had led him only into catastrophic conclusions, but he had too much information at his own disposal to be able to work in any other mode but the orthodox ones. Pharaoh and Yimo hadn't been hampered in that fashion. But as he followed along their line of reasoning, Binet began to notice a discomforting convergence of the numbers. By the third page, they had locked in with his own calculations, which he knew by heart by this time. And from there on, everything followed in an orderly way, step by step by step, to the same dismaying, shattering, inconceivable, totally unacceptable culminating result. Binet looked up at the two students, aghast. "There's no possibility, is there, that you've slipped up somewhere? This string of integrations here, for example, they look pretty tricky." "Sir," Yimo cried, sounding shocked to the core. His face was bright red, and his arms waved about as if moving of their own accord. Pharaoh said, more placidly, "I'm afraid they're correct, sir. They tally frontwards and backwards." "Yes, I imagine they do," said Binet dully. He struggled to conceal his anguish, but his hands were shaking so badly that the printout sheets began to flutter in his grasp. He started to put them down on the table before him, but his wrist jerked uncontrollably in a very Yimo-like gesture and sent them scattering all over the floor. Pharaoh knelt to pick them up. He gave Binet a troubled look. "Sir, if we've upset you in any way..." "No. No, not at all. I didn't sleep well today, that's the problem. But this is fine work, unquestionably very fine. I'm proud of you. To take a problem like this, one which has utterly no real-world resonance at all, which in fact is in total contradiction of real-world scientific truth, and to follow so methodically to the conclusion required by the data while succeeding in ignoring the fact that the initial premise is absurd, why, it's a splendid job. An admirable demonstration of your powers of logic. A first-rate thought experiment." He saw them exchange quick glances. He wondered if he was fooling them even slightly. "And now," he went on, "if you'll excuse me, fellows, I have another conference." Rolling the damning papers into a tight cylinder, Binet shoved them under his arm and rushed past them, out the door, down the hall, practically running, heading for the safety and privacy of his own tiny office. "My God," he thought. "My God, my God, my God, what have I done? And what will I do now?" He buried his head in his hands and waited for the throbbing to stop. But it didn't seem to be planning to stop. After a moment, he sat up and jabbed his finger against the communicator button on his desk.
"Get me the Saro City Chronicle," he told the machine. "Theremin 762.
From the communicator came a long, maddening burst of cracklings and hissings. Then suddenly, Theremin's deep voice.
"Features desk, Theremin 762.
Binet.
"What's that? I can't hear what you're saying."
Binet realized that he hadn't managed to get out anything more than a croak. "It's Binet," I said. I want to change our appointment time."
"To change it? Look, fellow, I understand how you feel about mornings, because so do I. But I've absolutely got to talk to you no later than noon tomorrow, or I'll have no story here. I'll make it up to you any way I can, but..."
"You don't understand. I want to see you sooner, not later, Theremin."
"What?"
"This evening. Let's say 9:30. Or 10, if you can't make it."
"I thought you had photographs to take at the observatory."
"The deuce with the photos, man. I need to see you."
"Need to? Binet, what's happened? Is it something with Raista?"
"It has nothing to do with Raista in the slightest. 9:30, at the Six Suns?"
"Six Suns, 9:30, yes," Theremin said. "It's a date."
Binet broke the contact and sat for a long moment staring at the rolled paper cylinder before him, somberly shaking his head. He felt fractionally calmer now, but only fractionally. Confiding in Theremin would make it easier to bear the burden of all this. He trusted Theremin completely. Newsmen were generally not noted for their trustworthiness, Binet knew. But Theremin was a friend first, a journalist after that. He had never betrayed Binet's confidence, not once. Even so, Binet didn't have any idea of his next move. Maybe Theremin would be able to come up with something. Maybe. He left the observatory by the back stairs, sneaking out by the fire escape like a thief. He didn't dare risk the possibility of running into Athor by going out the main way. It was appalling to him to consider the possibility of seeing Athor now, having to confront him face to face, man to man. He found the motor scooter ride home a terrifying one. At every moment he was afraid that the laws of gravity would cease to hold true, that he would go soaring off into the heavens. But at last, Binet reached the little apartment that he shared with Raista 717. She gasped when she saw him.
"Binet, you're white as a..."
"Ghost, yes." He reached for her and pulled her close against him.
"Hold me," he said.
"Hold me."
"What is it? What happened?"
"I'll tell you later," he said.
"Just hold me."